Welcome to the Healing Trauma and CPTSD Podcast. I'm your host, Monique Coven. I'm a certified trauma recovery coach, and this podcast is all about hope and recovery. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. Today, I'm going to share a conversation I had with Philippa Chinnery. And Philippa is a qualified counselor in the UK, and she's going to be sharing her journey of healing and self-worth. So Chinnery values difference and is passionate about supporting marginalized groups, helping them explore and uncover parts of themselves that may have been hidden. She believes the negative messages we can receive from friends, family, and society about ourselves can have a devastating effect on us. She's passionate about self-acceptance, self-awareness, and self-love. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Philippa. Hi, Philippa.
Hi, Monique.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
So we're going to be talking today about a little bit about your story, and it's going to be very relatable because it's on the subject of worthiness or a sense of self-worth, which is something that so many people, especially with trauma, can really relate to struggling with, you know, the sense of being feeling worthy or sense of value in who they are. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about it, in that it's your personal experience, as well as being a therapist.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Well, maybe I'll start with asking you just a little bit about what your childhood was like.
Yeah, sure. I think it was normal to me. As I think all our childhoods are, that there was a real differentiation between the adult roles and the children's roles. So, you know, children were to be seen and not heard. It's quite Victorian, seen and not heard. And you know, adults were very authoritarian. And my family's from Ghana in West Africa. And there was kind of a lot of emphasis on shame and on bringing shame into the family, acting a certain way. It's almost like a mask. You have a mask that you wear outside of the house where you can't be yourself. You're your best, most perfect self. That's not really you. And at home, you can be more yourself. But there's also lots of rules at home on how that looks.
So you're saying that the message was we have to appear like, you know, everything's really good and we're a certain way. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Yes. And I guess in terms of growing up, in terms of it was a happy childhood, but there was definitely emotions that were allowed in the house, and they were the happy ones, the positive ones, and kind of sadness wasn't allowed. It's kind of like, stop crying, stop, no more tears, it's okay. And any kind of sadness, unhappiness, anger, children weren't allowed to be angry, but adults were. So I think I started to become a fixer. I would look after people's feelings, make sure they were happy, cheer them up. So that kind of became my role in childhood, as to take care of people.
So you got the message really clearly that, sadness or anger was just not tolerated, but you did see the adults in the family being angry or showing their full range of emotions.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
It's interesting how then we come up with that kind of, I don't know how it happens, but that, like you said, that fixer, or you know, somehow it's my responsibility to fix what they're feeling, because we're supposed to be happy. And it's, yeah, that's quite a burden.
Yeah, it is. But obviously, well, we don't notice it when we have that role. It's just the way it is, and we're good at it. We're really good at it. So, we just carry on. And I think, yeah, we just carry on. And I think that for me, I had no idea what, I was so aware of what everyone else's needs were. I had no idea what my own were.
Yeah, that is so common. Or you're
Yeah.
so aware of what everybody's feeling, what, you know, how everybody's responding, but really, no, like you're not in touch with what you're feeling.
Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
So at what point did you start to realize that, like, you had a self-worth issue?
Do you know what? It took me such a long time. I think I was in my 30s when I kind of it really dawned on me. I think I'm quite an avoidant person, so I'm kind of just running around, getting on with life. So I was in my 30s and I'd just broken up with somebody. And usually I don't allow myself to feel things. I kind of push emotions down.
I wonder why. I'm just being sarcastic. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But on this occasion, I allowed myself to feel, which was completely new to me. So there was a lot going on for me. My dad was ill, so he'd been diagnosed with dementia, and I was kind of avoiding that. And then this breakup happened, and I couldn't, there was too much going on. It was too overwhelming for me to avoid everything. So that's why I almost had to feel, otherwise I would have exploded. So it was kind of then that I thought back. I was kind of looking back on my actions in this relationship, looking back on my life, and I thought, do you know, the things that I've allowed and the things I've tolerated, there's no way I could love myself because those are not the actions of somebody who does. And with that thinking, then came shame. How could I have done this to myself? Oh, you know that critical voice that kicks in? You know, so even though, okay, you've realized something, then it's like, wow. I'm the worst. How could I have done this to myself? I'm the worst kind of person. But then I had no real way of kind of thinking, of knowing what to do with that. And so I had all these affirmations that I stuck on my wall to kind of, oh, these will work.
I'm laughing because, I mean, that's the same thing as, like, you know, you're feeling, let's say, so horrible about yourself, and then
Yeah.
you mechanically recite, I am wonderful, I am perfect, I am, and like, as if that's supposed to magically change the way that you feel.
It doesn't. And I had no idea why. I thought, well, but this doesn't work. And I call it my papering over the cracks period of I think of it as a house that's got rotten foundations, and rather than kind of demolishing the house and treating the foundations and maybe taking out the foundations and putting new ones in, I'm continuing to build my house and papering over all the cracks that appear with my affirmations. Yeah.
Yeah, they're
So,
called
yeah.
band-aids.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I love the metaphor, though. I think a lot of people can relate to the house. I've even used that before and thought of that because that's very much what it's like. And I like the way you said about the foundation because that's really where we need to start, isn't it?
Exactly. It's so important to start there, but it's also really painful to start there. Exactly. And yeah. And I think, yeah, I worked with my affirmations and I made it work. I kept sticking them up. The band-aids got thicker.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we work with whatever we think is going to help. And frankly, I mean, that message of affirmations, it's, I mean, it's still out there. You just look anywhere and you see, recite these affirmations for this or that. And the intentions are wonderful, but it's not always effective, as we know, you know, when we have like these root kind of issues or traumas. So, how did it kind of show up for you? You talked about a little bit, it really showed up with the partner that you had and how you, you know, maybe saw yourself being, tolerating certain things. How else did it show up for you?
Well, quite different ways, but I think that they're quite common, I think, for a lot of us. So I didn't take up space, you know? And that can be, you know, even physically, I wouldn't take up space. I would sit on a bus and kind of squeeze myself so that the person next to me could have space. Or in relationships, then it was all about the other person, whether it's a friendship, a family relationship, the other person was more important. And I had to kind of create the space for them to take it up.
Wow. It sounds a lot like some of the behavior that you found yourself in as a child when you described yourself as a fixer, you know. Yes. It's like about them, and then we kind of get disconnected from ourselves. That's so interesting, because I hear a lot of people say they feel like there's no space for themselves. So
And I think even if I was given the space, I wouldn't know what to do with it anyway, because I'm so used to not having it. And also not using my voice, not asserting myself, not setting boundaries. And if I did, then there would be no consequences, and I wouldn't restate the boundary if it was ever broken. I would just think, well, I've tried and it didn't work, and this is my life. Yeah.
I'm sure people can relate to that for sure. Mm-hmm. So what would you say would have been like the hardest part of having, you know, just the sense of like low self-worth, or this feeling, this chronic feeling of, you know, not being worthy of taking up space? What do you think was the hardest part?
Do you know what? I think I was blissfully ignorant for a long time. So a lot of it I thought was just normal. Like, this is normal. If I feel bad about myself, or if I feel resentful that I think maybe people take advantage of me because, you know, I'm giving all the time, but that's what I'm supposed to do. I'd really internalized those messages from childhood that, you know, that's what a good person does. And I wanted to be a good person. So I think the hardest part was the realization that I did actually have low self-worth, and that I suppose looking back on my life, I had tolerated things that I didn't have to. I think that was the hardest thing, because then the shame, I think I've spoken about the shame before, that comes in really hard. And then the critical voice comes in. How could you do that? It's kind of like a cycle. You know, get the shame, and you criticize yourself, and then you get more ashamed. I think that was the hardest thing.
And you know, I'm a visual person, so as you're speaking, I'm like imagining like you're already so low, and then I have this picture of just then being just kicked when you're already so low.
Absolutely.
So what worked for you to start to, let's say, rebuild your sense of self-worth?
I think it's something that I talk to my own clients about a lot. But it's self-compassion. Self-compassion is so important. And it was a completely alien concept to me. I didn't understand how that would even work, because I thought, well, how am I supposed to get anything done if I'm kind of sitting down and I guess stroking my own hair and kind of
Well, there's two things there, but one of them that when you said, I don't, I mean, I hear that a lot, for especially for people who've never been shown compassion. How on earth are you supposed to show it to yourself if you've never been shown? It's so, so foreign, and it must have been for you. And then the other part is that, yeah, I think a lot of people have that fear that, oh, if I tell myself, it's okay, take it easy, I won't get anything done.
Exactly. That's exactly where I was. And I remember being in therapy myself and my therapist talking about, you know, self-compassion. And I remember just looking at her thinking, this woman is crazy. Like, what? What do you mean? Mm-hmm. But then for me, I guess I haven't said, but my worth was very much in, it was very much caught up in how much I could give and how much I could produce. And I couldn't ever be still. I had to be doing something to prove how worthy I was. And so the idea of sitting down and kind of, you know, letting myself do a good enough job and not a perfect job, it was no, that makes no sense. None. But I guess working together, I kind of slowly learned to quieten my critical voice and also flex my self-compassionate muscle, which took a lot of flexing. It took a lot of work in the gym to get that muscle to be even a little bit strong. It was very limp, very weak.
How would you suggest someone to, you know, might find that concept of self-compassion, like I said, completely unrelatable? They don't know how. What's a little way that you could start to maybe get in touch with a little bit of self-compassion?
Okay, I think, well, what worked for me was just to notice my critical voice, because I think it was just always there. It was so much a part of me that I didn't even notice when I was being critical. It was just the constant voice. And so if I'd done something that I thought, oh, I've done something wrong, or something has not turned out the way I wanted it to, and then you have that little voice in the back of your head saying, oh my God, I can't believe you did that wrong, you're useless, you're whatever. It was just to even notice it. Just that, take that first step of noticing mm-hmm. when you're criticizing yourself, because when you notice it, that's when you can kind of start to counteract it. And that's when I would bring in my more compassionate voice, and I did some work with my therapist about, you know, some parts work, mm-hmm. the different parts of the self. So I had my critical part and my compassionate part, and I could visualize them, you know, whatever works for me. And it was the visual, because I'm also a visual person. So I think about what they looked like and what they were wearing and the looks on their faces. And it was really whenever that critical voice came in, kind of conjuring up my compassionate voice to kind of counteract it. And, you know, just to turn the volume down, because I couldn't turn it off. I couldn't make my critical voice stop, but I could turn the volume down. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's different ways, I guess, to look at the critical voice, but I for sure it starts with, like you said, really paying attention and being aware that it's there, because sometimes it's just blah, 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 and we think it's us and it's a part of our, you know, being. And when you kind of notice it and how it's not very nice and that we don't have to really attach to it, I agree with you that you don't have to. I mean, we can't change it, but we certainly can turn the volume down and don't engage with it and don't, like, yeah, I am a horrible person, you know, like join in and make it kind of stick or worse. So that's what you started to do. And I guess you did some parts work.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And then how did that kind of help you to see yourself in a more compassionate way? I mean, you see, okay, I've got this critical voice, but how did you really start to, you know, kind of align with yourself and feel compassion?
I think the parts work also helps me to, I guess, in well I hate to talk really therapeutically because I think it alienates quite a few people, but to integrate all the different parts of myself, to like really have the different parts of self come together. And another thing that we also did with my therapist was inner child work, which I hated with a passion, because I hated my inner child.
Yep, I relate. I was the same way.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting how we have such hatred when we start engaging? I mean, when you think about it, especially now being on the other side, I think, how could you hate a suffering younger part? But it just goes to show the kind of, experiences and pain that that part went through.
Yes, exactly. And it's a part that you don't want to see. It disgusts you. So if you can just put it in a box and put it away and not have to look at it or think about it, then everything will be fine because everything that comes with that younger part feels so overwhelming, doesn't it?
Yes. And I even went as far as, I don't know if you could relate to this, but I remember feeling like blaming her. You're causing all my anxiety today. And I was like really angry at the younger part.
Yes, exactly. Because it just makes sense because that's what the problem is. It's this younger part that it just doesn't, it feels like it doesn't belong. And so it is to blame for everything. So yes. And so I remember sitting in my therapist's office and her kind of talking about imagining my inner child. And I just imagine this raggedy like this, like an orphan. You know those old films that they used to have orphans like from the workhouse in London in rags? Like I just imagined this sorry looking child, and I thought, oh my God, how disgusting. And I just didn't want her. I wasn't it then, it wasn't even her. I didn't want it near me. And I felt very uncomfortable doing that work, but it was actually as uncomfortable as it was, it actually was really, really good for me in helping me to kind of accept this part of myself, this vulnerable, and it's the vulnerability I didn't like. It was accepting that vulnerable part of myself.
It's so I did the same process as you did with the parts work, and I can remember it being really difficult. And I don't know if you felt the same way, but one of the ways that shifted my relationship with my inner child was when I when the therapist was showing compassion for that inner child, and she was having compassion for her and really seeming to be not emotional, but just I could feel her compassion for that child, and I thought, and I'm feeling so disconnected. But when I saw her compassion for the inner child and that inner child suffering, I realized, yeah, she really must have suffered. And there was an adult that finally validated and had compassion for that part, and that was really helpful in me being able to have compassion. Does any of that relate to what do you can you relate to that in any way?
I can, but I think it took me a while because I didn't trust those. I didn't trust when I saw the compassion. I didn't trust it. I was very suspicious. Like, what do you want? What is this for? What do you want from me? So it took me a while to trust it. So I think I was really avoidant, and very much, I don't like this. I don't want to do this. This feels strange. The compassion felt too much. Does that make sense? Felt
Oh,
like too much.
it does. And I think it felt very threatening and unsafe for you because it's so unfamiliar.
Exactly.
So was there anything like in particular that you did with this particular therapist that actually you saw started to kind of break through or work?
I think because we did the parts work, we did the inner child work, and I think it was kind of honing in on, okay, you don't like vulnerability, you don't like being vulnerable, you see yourself as, well, I see myself as a a strong, self-reliant person who doesn't need anybody but can be the shoulder for everybody in the world. But nobody can deal with any of my stuff because it's too much. And I think it was the relationship with my therapist, really,
yes,
in learning to trust her, that kind of opened me up to connecting with myself. Does that make sense?
That was my experience. That is really, yeah, that makes sense. Very much so. And she may have been the first adult that you established a real sense of trust with. I don't know.
Yeah, I think she probably was, to be fair. Yeah.
Wow. So it was really, you would say, the trust with her that really started to help you.
Yeah. Yes. And actually letting it in, letting someone's compassion in. Because I imagine myself like a little, like a human shield that's just constantly up and nothing can get in.
Yeah.
And so it's just opening up a crack and then a bit more and then a bit more to just let some good things in.
That makes so much sense, especially in the context of growing up where, nope, not allowed to feel sad. No, not allowed to feel angry. Well, of course you're going to have, this shield up. And as we know, when we grow up, that goes along with us. It doesn't just disappear because we're now adults. And so, it's beautiful that you started to be able to open up cracks and more cracks. So what did you kind of take away from the work, like with your therapist or with the process, would you say?
Ooh, what did I take away? I think that therapy works for one.
Yeah. Yay, therapy.
Also, I think it's never too late to start working on your self-worth. Because I was in my 30s and I was kind of thinking, wow, all of this life has gone past and now I'm only starting to work on this now, but it's never too late.
Never.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. And I've heard that. I can't even count how many times I've heard that from my own clients thinking, they're 30. Oh my gosh, it's so late. No, we're growing all the time, we're growing all the time and it's cumulative and it's great. So is there anything else you wanted to add to this conversation about, self-worth and your story that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd like to add is that I didn't mention how race, I guess, affected my self-worth. I think growing up in the 80s in London, you didn't really see many black people on TV unless they were criminals, so kind of playing criminals, or if they were comedians, kind of entertaining. So that was, I guess, two roles that I could see were available for black people. Sorry, were you going to say something?
No, well, I was just thinking, that's so true. I could imagine that you're seeing TV and really what we see on TV, we kind of think that that's a representation of what the world is. And so so for you as a child or even as an adult watching that, I could see why you would think that. But that's not something that I think people who are not of color would think of.
Definitely. And I think just looking different. London is really a melting pot. There's so many different types of people here. But I think, again, if I look towards the media, which is kind of being put into your face through TV anyway, people just didn't look like me. And I was, dark skinned. I didn't have the same type of body. And it was just really hard for me, I think, to see the beauty in, I guess, me.
How
I mean, if
about
I
it? How about at home? What, did you get a sense of a pride for, from your family about yourself or?
Well, I think it's quite difficult because my parents, they come from a colonized country. So there are, I mean, it tends to be that, the closer, the fairer you are, the better you are. Or, the more Eurocentric your features, the better you are. And my mum told me that she used to squeeze my nose when I was a baby to try and make it more narrow.
Oh. Well, so she obviously got that message herself, and then did she tell you that as a child?
Yeah, she did. She
Oh,
did.
dear.
Yeah, she used to tell me, my dad was fairer skinned. So she said, oh, his skin's lovely. Like you can see his freckles and all that kind of thing. And I didn't have that skin tone. So, yeah. So,
Wow. Now I'm just thinking, so the messages are coming at you and even from your own family about you know, physical, how you look physically.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so you thought that what you looked like wasn't right, didn't fit in, wasn't beautiful. Oh, what a
Yes.
shame.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, I think, that it does come in. I think with race, it comes from society, but it also comes from your family. And I suppose, like most things, we do internalize a lot of things from our family, and it should be the place where, we're getting all the positive messages. But, I guess it's just another level where we internalize things that, make us feel bad about ourselves.
And it's interesting because, I'm thinking of someone I know who was raised in a different culture, and the family, even though they didn't live in that country, they were very, very proud, and they kept talking to their children growing up about, the heritage of that country. So, sometimes there's like pride, but what you're describing is there was almost a shame of it wasn't okay to be, to be who you were.
I mean, don't get me wrong, there's pride also, but I think colonization has played a part, especially for people my parents' generation, because they're quite old. It played a part in kind of, I guess, letting them know, just in terms of the way they look and the way they speak, that, you're not quite the standard. And so that's internalized by them. But there's pride in the culture. But then there is, I think there's, it can be insidious, the way that it sneaks in.
So how did that, I mean, I can hear how that would have contributed to how you feel, or felt rather, about yourself and growing up. So how did that start to shift for you?
I think I just, I mean, my parents used to always, tell me stories, and they used to tell me all about the culture. I did not want to know because I wanted to be just like everybody else. So I was kind of like, leave me alone. I don't want to know. Stop talking to me about this. But then I guess the older I got, the more interested I got in my own culture and in kind of just learning more about my roots, I guess. So I learned a bit more. I listened to them a bit more, paid more attention to what they were saying. And yeah, the pride started to come
Oh,
from
lovely.
there.
Oh, that's so lovely. And so has your, I mean, in terms of who you are and your feelings of self-worth, now, how do you see yourself today?
I mean, right now, I think it's probably lucky that you've got me right now because I feel probably the best that I've felt about myself. And, I feel really good in my skin. I'm really accepting of myself and all of my different intersections. So I'm really loving being a woman. I'm really loving being a black woman. I'm just loving every minute of it and just really, I guess, yeah, just taking up all the space that I never used to take up. I'm really loving
Oh, I love that. I love that.
it.
There's lots and lots of space for you. I love that because yeah, this idea that we have to, like you were describing earlier in our conversation about really shrinking and, you know, not taking up too much space. I love hearing that you feel like there's that you can take lots and lots of space and that you're beautiful, really. I also want to say, I've heard you laugh a few times in this episode, and you have just such a wonderful laugh. It's so, I could feel the joy. So it's lovely.
Thank you.
Oh, I'd like to watch a funny movie with you, I think. Hear you laugh. Oh. Well, anyways, I really enjoyed this conversation with you. And if people want to find out more about your work or get in touch with you, how can they reach out to you?
Yeah, you can find me online. My website is www.philippachinnery.com. And I'm also on Instagram and Facebook. It's philippa.chinnery.counseling.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, thank you again for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Trauma healing and recovery starts to happen in the context of a safe, attuned, and empathetic relationship. To find out more about my trauma recovery coaching options, you could reach me on my website at www.cptsdcoach.com. You can also visit me on Instagram and Facebook at cptsdcoach.